Hello and welcome to the first Yes to Life show 2020 here on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, founder of the UK charity Yes to Life and host for the show, which focuses on integrative medicine for cancer. I hope you've had a good holiday of some sort over the Xmas period and have been able to take some time to relax and enjoy yourself with friends and family. In fact, if you're relaxing so much that you missed last week's Yes to Life show, I do urge you to look it up on Listen On Demand, as it focused entirely on an upcoming event for the charity Yes to Life, the Big Week Off. It's a January detox for body and mind, and a chance to restore some equilibrium after maybe a little too much fun over Christmas. It runs from the 12th to the 18th of January, and you get to choose one of the three programmes devised by Liz Butler, a 1 day, a 4 day, or the full Monty, 7 days. You can read more about it on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk. There's a link to the Big Week Off right at the top of the page. Now on to this week's show. My guest is a very eminent UK doctor, Dr. Michael Dixon. Dr. Dixon is probably best known for his work as chairman of the College of Medicine, a vehicle to support and promote integrative medicine amongst professionals, and for championing social prescribing, a completely novel approach to primary care in the community. In amongst such national initiatives, he's a busy GP with a pioneering practice in Columpton, where he sought to completely rethink the role and the resources of a GP practice. I've been meaning to visit to see the college surgery for myself for years, and so I'm very pleased to finally get here and to ask Dr. Dixon all about it. Thanks very much, Steve, for inviting me down to your surgery. I've been meaning to come here for years, and very glad to see it firsthand. I've heard lots about it.
Well, it's really nice to have you here.
Great.
Thanks for coming, Robin.
So it has to be said that the college surgery here, maybe along with Mr. Everington's over in Tower Hamlets, is decades ahead of other surgeries in the way that it's set up with its aims. You know, the whole ambience of it is very far ahead of most surgeries. So how come? How come you two are so far ahead of the curve?
Well, probably for different reasons. I mean, for me, it started off with the complementary medicine, because after about 9 or 10 years as a GP, I was feeling very beleaguered. There were so many people coming in with things that I couldn't treat, like irritable bowel, like even things like back pain and neck pain and chronic tiredness, frequent infections. These things conventional medicine doesn't treat very well, and I was feeling unarmed against this whole sea of human misery. And that's when I started taking interest in complementary medicine, and a feeling, well, wouldn't it be nice to be having complementary practitioners on site and offering integrated medicine? And that really started a whole set of hairs running, because once we've got the complementary practitioners here, I began to think, well, actually this is about self-activation, this is about patients having a greater role in their own health and well-being. And so we developed the gardens, and then we developed various classes, yoga classes and Tai Chi and meditation. Now it's very much in the hands of the patients themselves. So if you like, the ongoing expansion of what we do, and with social prescription, this is all getting very connected to what the community does. And I suppose for me, it's an expression really of what general practice should be doing in future. It should be an implicit part of creating better health in the local community, so that people don't need to access us quite as much as they do already.
Well, that's nice idea in most cases, but here you've actually been making it a reality. Fantastic, you've taken all these steps, and I think probably the most striking thing is the amount of patient involvement here, which is just, that's very unusual, isn't it? And maybe you want to say a bit about that, the ways they're involved, what they're doing.
Yes, but also, first of all, the principle, really, Robin, because, you know, the health service is predicated on every man helping each other, so that when you're ill, you don't go bankrupt, you don't feel unsupported, in a sense, if you like, the wealthier helping the poor to make sure everyone has good health service. Well, you see, if you take that down to local level here in the individual surgery, the individual town, surely there needs to be that same ethos if that ethos on high is going to survive, especially at a time when resources are very scarce, when you can't get enough doctors and nurses, and where the whole pressure is to try and make sure that wherever possible, people are unable to look after themselves and keep their health good enough so that they are less likely to fall ill. And that's really the ethos that lies behind this surgery, which is patients in the community doing as much as they possibly can in terms of health and care, so that the professional time, the expensive time, the technological stuff is kept for only when it's necessary. Right. So it's about sustainability of the health system, which is not sustainable at present the way we're going. I think it's estimated that America goes on as it does for 50 years, it'll be spending all its GDP on health in 50 years' time. Well, clearly that's not possible. So you have to think of something different. And that different, I think, is the community and individuals being far, far more involved in how the local health service runs and local health and well-being. And so what we're doing here is sort of symbolically doing a first stab at it. I mean, it's very kind of you to say that there's a lot going on here, but I'm all too aware of what we're still not doing. But what we are doing is we have the gardens, we have patients measuring their own blood pressure and weight on a machine that the patients have paid for. We've got 12 different sorts of complementary practitioner. We've got the local schools being involved in health schemes and paintings. We've got the patients here leading walk and talk, so that people that want to do graduated exercise into the countryside can do so with a reliable leader. And in the back space, we've got lots of volunteers doing different sorts of things. I mean, for instance, one of the real problems in general practice today is that if you have someone with a child and adolescent mental health problem, and this is an unbelievable statistic, but it's true, 3/4 of my referrals as an average GP are turned down. So I'm left looking after a lot of very unhappy children, adolescents, and some very unhappy parents as well. Yeah. And the answer here, and bless their hearts, has been we have retired health visitors, primary school teachers, social workers, and the rest who actually do a voluntary counselling service called Families Connecting, where they will take the child, the parent, the whole family sometimes, and try and see what can be done, using people with experience to do that, but volunteers, because there's no other service. And that's the sort of thing we're doing here, throughout the system, which is to fill in those gaps that the professionals can't.
Very interesting. I mean, that's a kind of creative solution where the setup has formed the path, basically, the stepping in volunteers. I'm interested to hear from the patient's perspective, I suppose they can't compare because they haven't had either, but do they find it a good and satisfactory service? Is it genuinely helpful?
Yes. I mean, it's very gratifying. A lot, they really do appreciate it. Mm. And lots of patients say they're not moving away elsewhere simply because they want to stay with the surgery. And people come from elsewhere say they're very surprised to see what they find. And I suppose when they say that, I say, yes, but remember, you're coming into a different ethos. Because my ambition, at the moment we have a wonderful patient group and lots of patient leaders and 200 people on email who help out, but my ambition is that we don't register patients in future. Well, we will do bureaucratically, but that patients regard themselves not as patients of the practice but as members. So we have mutual rights and responsibilities, and this is something I explain to patients when they first come here, that not only are they going to be able to take away something, perhaps a bit more than they got previously, but it's also up to all of us to give a bit as well, and that giving and taking is very good for health anyway. We know that the more you give, the longer you live.
Right. I haven't heard that maxim, but yes, a good one. Really interesting. I mean, I think it's very creative. The way you described how healthcare should be at the beginning there, It had majorly lost its way from that to becoming this thing where you just go along and you expect to be told out with the answer to your problem,
yes,
without you having any input whatsoever, financial or otherwise, you know.
Yes.
And it's just going to be given to you, the answer. And the fact it never really worked very well is not surprising. You know, it's obviously, it's brilliant for some things, absolutely brilliant. You know, if you've got a crisis, it's marvellous for sure. But for these things that build up over time and all the rest of it, to get the sort of instant solution and the pill pot is, well, it's never going to work really. And so I think you're coming up with some brilliant ideas here as to how to make this actually work. And the philosophy of getting people engaged in their own health is probably the root of the whole thing, really, isn't it? That's what makes it potentially work.
Yes, I think if we know that if you're treating a patient and they want to try, say, acupuncture or whatever, that you're already onto a winner before they have that treatment. That's to say, if they're engaged and want, and if you like, somehow symbolically in their own mind, that treatment is the thing that they want to go for, then ergo it's more likely to work than the other treatment. And I think this is the emancipation of care in many ways. And don't underestimate, I mean, yes, we're fantastic if you need your arteries reboring with a stent or with cancer. Some of the treatments now, although the rates of cancer are increasing, the cure rates for cancer have vastly increased. So all that is very good. But we are fundamentally failing on a very major level, because the rates of stress, of anxiety, of depression, of obesity, of diabetes, of cancer, all these things are increasing very quickly. And everything we're doing is not stopping that exponential increase. And the only way we will do it is by changing the behavior of a local community like this, by changing what goes on in the schools, by changing what people are buying in the supermarket, by changing who's going to the gym, by changing the environment they're living in, the cycle paths, the walking facilities, the organic vegetables and fruit, etc. Unless you start doing that, you are really just blowing in the wind.
So it's a very, very much broader view of what constitutes healthcare than would have been seen a little while ago then, to actually bring in all those other things and to acknowledge how crucial a role most of those things have in people's actual health, their physical health and well-being.
Yes.
And
It's a bit like that analogy of the, you know, you've got the basin running and the taps flowing, you know, and the idea at the moment is all we're doing is mopping up the water as it spills over the basin with our 10-minute consultations and our patch-up treatments. But if you actually take the plug out of the basin and let the water out, then you don't have the problem in the first place, or not to the same extent anyway.
Okay, well, one of the most exciting things going on here is integration, says it as you drive in. And it's pretty clear that from the way you're talking, you're looking at the GP as one of the resources that's open to patients. You know, not the healthcare resource, but one of them. You know, this is a bit of a contrast still to how it's seen in most places. I think it's still seen like this is healthcare. And, you know, it is a 10-minute consultation. It is what the computer prescribes for you. But in order for a wider adoption of integration to happen, the kind of view that you've adopted, which is of seeing yourself as one of the resources available to patients, a very important one, but, you know, there are other ones as well. That has to happen, because as long as, you know, conventional medicine sits in the place of being the option for medicine, then integration will never really happen. It'll always be a nice to have, pay for it yourself off somewhere privately, you know. It won't be part of healthcare, and it won't be integrated, which is the important word, which is that you as a doctor won't be thinking, you know, oh, well, actually they'd be really helped by some acupuncture. That's never going to happen. So how do you think that this move of mindset, if you like, is going to happen? Do you think it's happening, and is there anything that can actually encourage it?
Well, yes, I do think it's happening, and sadly it's not happening amongst my generation, Robin, but I'm seeing a younger generation, especially in the College of Medicine, lots of young doctors, young nurses, allied professionals who really don't get this division between the complementary and the conventional.
Excellent.
All they want is something that works. Right. And they're not that bothered why it works, provided it's safe and it's not too expensive. And I think that they are redescribing medicine. And we have in the college networks of students, for instance, take social prescription. We've got four or five students in every medical school who are leading social prescription, and they have an annual conference every year, which NHS England subsidises. On our first social prescribing day in March this year, we had something like 15 million social media interactions. And this is a sort of revolution by the students themselves. Mm. And not only in the thinking between the conventional and the complementary, but take that network of social prescription, what they're realising is that health is far beyond tablets and procedures, that it involves artistic interventions, green interventions, exercise, healthy eating, and all the rest of it. And they're not necessarily the doctors of the future, or even the nurses, going to be doing it themselves. By their interest in social prescription, there'll be lots of link workers who will be connecting their patients to these interventions, often by their suggestion, the social prescription, if you like, being made by the GP, but the link worker being the person that does it. But even then, it's going to go beyond the link worker, because if you go to someone like Frome, you've got people called community connectors who connect to the professional link worker and then send people in the community, and they're often people that work in the post office or people that work in the fire service, who then refer patients to these other sorts of facilities.
And so this is not going via the GP at all?
Not going by. In fact, the ambition in Frome is that every person in the community will be a community connector. So, right. If you like, it's back to the future of a connected community.
Which in itself is a great thing, of course.
It's a great
part
thing.
Of the problem is the disconnectedness of people and the stress it induces.
It's the alienation.
All those things that you've described.
It is
already.
Totally. We've lost the wise women on the local estate. We've lost the people who, you know, I mean, even, you know, we held the debacle about the post offices recently. Well, you know, the person that delivers your letters is actually a really important part of the community in terms of checking, you know, people's milk bottles have been collected, or the well and the rest of it. And we've totally, much to our discredit, we've totally undervalued this whole value of people being connected and going the last mile and looking after each other in favour of a very virtual community, which sees shopping by Amazon, which sees communication instead of by word of mouth being by text or by email. And we feel we're communicating better, but we're not. We're communicating far worse, and we're connecting worse than that.
I think a part of that, I feel, goes down to this, particularly in healthcare, goes down to the sort of deferring to experts thing, which, of course, in a certain way, you know, I'm right behind experts, you know, particularly with cancer, it's such a complex thing. But actually, also, people themselves can become experts on their own condition, and they do. I know hundreds of people who know more about their own condition than anybody else, so they should be listened to if they say something. But I was thinking of the example you gave there, where actually you've, you know, mental health is something where we deferred more and more to experts to deal with it. But actually, because you haven't got any experts, you've actually handed over to the community.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, they're doing it very well. And at the same time, they're building the community that needs to be built.
Yes, totally. I think we're looking at a sort of a change in direction, really, because the way I'm paid almost, but certainly the culture is that I take in all expert evidence from National Institute of Clinical Excellence and people like that, and then I apply that evidence to you as the patient with my opinion as to where the evidence is relevant to you. And you're a bit like Alexander Beetle at the end of Winnie the Pooh's Row, you know, receiving the evidence, the clinical opinion and all the rest of it. And as you imply, the future has to be the reverse of that, with the patient at the centre, the patient, the expert on the patient.
Right.
the doctor advising on what he knows about clinical knowledge that might be helpful to that expert as a patient,
right,
using evidence to back his case. But this sort of tyranny of evidence, yeah, being thrust upon people who have their own views, and they're not a, you know, they're not like a billiard ball with one hit going in a different direction. We're black boxes. We are self-healing creatures, and unless you take the brain and the mind and those factors into account, you're missing an enormous trick in what's possible.
Mm-hmm. Right. So. Something I've always admired about you is the way you work on the macro and the micro level all at the same time. You're here, hands-on with your patients. You're also dealing with things on a kind of health policy level as well. And I think that's what's probably enabled you to come up with some proposals for things which are actually workable and actually could really help people. You know, not the disembodied experts up there in London deciding what everybody should get, but you've come up with some ideas about what people need. Now, you've already mentioned the thing which probably one of your best things that you've been involved with is social prescribing, which you've been waving the flag for like mad. And it completely caught me by surprise in a way, social prescribing. I didn't see that coming, and I would never have predicted the potential it has for change. You know, I sort of got it slowly. Wait a minute, this is big, you know. And but not everybody's caught up with social prescribing yet. They don't even know what it is, some people. So do you want to say a little bit about what it is and the ways you think it's going to change healthcare?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to and is already changing healthcare immeasurably. I mean, it grew out of an idea in this surgery 15 years ago, I think now, when one of the Secretary of States, well, it was Alan Johnson, great Secretary of State for Health, he came down here, and I was banging on about the fact that lots of conditions are really difficult to treat using only the conventional method. You know, things like chronic tiredness, things like migraines, things like back pain. And he said, okay, why don't we, the Department of Health, fund you with local universities to produce some really useful stuff for patients, which gives all the evidence for treatment for these conditions, but includes lifestyle, includes complementary, includes conventional. So with Exeter University and Westminster University, we produce this fantastic leaflets and information telling people what the level of information was in terms of efficacy and safety and everything else. We haven't finished this, and it was a very big undertaking. We suddenly realized that just producing videos and leaflets was just too old hat in a way. We still weren't going to get under the skin of demoralized people who really needed to perhaps change their lifestyle, who really needed to look at life in a totally different mindset. And that's when we thought about the desktop prescriber, and then we thought we need somebody to be doing this. And so Ruth Tucker here was the first social prescribing facilitator,
right,
who started using some of this material and seeing patients for a while, taking them around the supermarket, showing them, you know, what really was going to help them to lose weight and what wasn't, etc., etc. And this sort of then began to take off. A lot of people at the time were saying, well, this is all very nice, but it sounds a bit fanciful. Can you prove in biomedical terms that it really works? So our next undertaking, this is about 12 years ago, was to take 130, 140 people who are very overweight with diabetes or pre-diabetes and see if Ruth could change things. To cut a long story short, she managed to convert a third of our diabetics to no longer being so, a third of those with diabetes or at risk. And London School of Economics showed that we'd actually save money in year, quite apart from the long-term consequences if people don't have amputations and something else. So then the argument was beginning to be won. And I then got 12 or 15 colleagues together nationally. There's some wonderful people. There was Chris Drinkwater up in Newcastle, who had taken unemployed men and they joined a fishing club and shown the extraordinary things that happen when people start interacting and feeling a sense of achievement and enjoying life. And there was James Fleming, a GP in Burnley, where people die earlier than anywhere else in the country. He'd suddenly said to himself one Monday morning, patients coming in without jobs, why am I giving them Prozac? Why aren't I giving them occupational experience to help them to get a job? And so about 12 of us linked together, we formed a national leadership group for social prescription. We then opened a network, which now has 3,000 members. And then NHS England saw what we were doing and said, let's link forces. And the sort of the rest is history, culminating. And you, as you say, it's as surprising to me as it is to you that it's gone so fast, because it was only 4 years ago we did this.
It's really met a need, isn't it?
It's met a need,
like,
I think.
It's like lighting a fire.
Lighting a fire, and this from this year, July onwards, there's a link worker now in every group of GP practices throughout England, and there will be two or three in 3 or 4 years' time. And I think that people are suddenly realising that, that, you know, our health and well-being is so much more than, you know, simply drugs and procedures. And it's so counterintuitive. You go to somewhere like Rotherham, for instance, and they've taken the 2 or 3% of patients there who most use hospital services, and they've shown that within a year they are using hospitals and GP services 20% less. But if you look at the over 80-year-olds, 4 or 5 years later, they're using these services 50% less. Wow. So give someone a purpose, a meaning in life. Give them a point of waking up, something to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and think, ah, yes, that's next. Yeah. And suddenly their health, their well-being, their attitude, their morale changes. Mm. And not only for them, but for people around them as well. You know, this has a whole community effect in time. And that's what we're beginning to see. So you know, social prescription for me is actually only the first course. It's the entree. The main course is to build up sufficient capital in the community, social capital, in terms of an extended offer for the volunteer and voluntary services offered by the social prescribing link workers. So you then have a community that has all this infrastructure that actually makes people well in the first place, instead of what's happening at the moment, alienates them, makes them ill, and then they come in here to see me.
Amazing. Yeah, very different picture. Very different. Yeah, no, it's great. I love it. One thing I'm interested to ask is, I mean, you started off here well before social prescription was around, but with a bunch of complementary therapists in-house here. It's a separate organisation, if you like. In a way, you're a GP practice and there are a lot of practitioners. But are you now able to refer patients to them on the NHS? Is that possible yet?
Well, that's a long-term aim, Robin, but I'm afraid the short answer is no. I recommend plenty of patients to them several times each surgery. The osteopaths, for instance, have a service for those that can't afford the normal rates, which is something like a third of the rate. So we give them these little tickets, which mean that more people can access an osteopath.
Right.
We have a local charity in the town which will sometimes give grants to people that can't afford it to have complementary therapy. But no, I'm afraid the closest I've got to the NHS funding complementary therapy is to get our primary care trust, as it then was, to fund Tai Chi classes, accepting the enormous weight of evidence that people with Parkinson's disease or following strokes or with balancing disorders or even depression are helped by Tai Chi. We've got to build up more evidence for the complementary therapies, but I think we've got to create a sort of people power in the sense of people being allowed to try it and see if it benefits them, rather than maybe being judgmental, which the conventional community has been. I think personal budgets have been a big way in there, because will allow patients to decide what treatment they do have, rather than it being decided by the commissioner. I think the water's trickling through the floodgates already, but I can't pretend that we're anywhere near that yet.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? It's that one of actually getting the NHS cash behind it, saying, well, actually, this is a better thing to spend money on than this, is a tough one, isn't it? I mean, that's the cracking the nut in a way.
It is.
They're very interested in the saving money by posting them off to a load of people who are volunteering to do stuff for free.
Yes.
But that's not quite the same thing as actually putting their money behind something that's actually better.
That's totally true. And if you were to argue on their behalf, they'd say they're using public money. You've got to be sure that public money is well spent. And the current vernacular for deciding that is evidence-based. And an evidence base which is extremely biomedically based, which may not be appropriate for complementary therapy. So that's what you'd say as a commissioner. If you're a complementary therapist or an integrated therapist, you'd say this is a extremely uneven argument, because 0% of the NHS budget is spent on complementary medicine, so it's highly biased against there even being the evidence in the first place. And then when the evidence comes out, quite often it's not even used. I mean, we've seen it with the NICE guidelines on back pain.
What I'd like to see is for the health service A, to be running its own real world trials, so that we can have actual evidence of what happened to real world patients that were going through. They're not doing, they could have been doing that since 1940, whatever it was. They don't do it. It's ridiculous to rely on third parties to come up with the evidence. They should get their own. And secondly, they should be just interested in what works.
But Robin, I couldn't agree with that more. I mean, we're trickling towards that position. So, for instance, Debbie Sharp got a grant of some $170,000 from the Department of Health to scope what sorts of complementary intervention would be most likely to be proven to be helpful as a means then of getting funding for that research. She then put in a very good research application to the National Institute for Healthcare Research, the NIHR, got to the second stage of that, but it didn't happen. And but you know, that's better than it's been in the past. And if you want my take on that, I think, you know, there are quite a lot of people who are willing this to happen, but there are also quite a lot of inertia in the system that ultimately says, well, complementary medicine isn't quite as important as heart stents or ambulances or the rest of it. And that really needs to change.
Well, I mean, I think I can see the case of what you just said. You could say, yeah, heart stents going to save somebody's life, you know, massage probably isn't. And that's fair enough, but that's not the real comparison. Most of the money in the NHS, I imagine, goes on regularly prescribed drugs that people take for decades.
Yes.
And that have very poor results, and usually then require another drug to counter the side effect of the first one, and then a third one. You build them up, and by that you have these people who are taking, you know, 10, 15, 20 drugs by the time they're in their old age. That must cost the earth.
Totally.
It doesn't work very well. We know that.
It doesn't.
So,
no, I think, and you've got a very good point there, and 80% of my working life is spent looking after people with long-term conditions, which aren't curable, you know, by definition. So, and they're the ones that are using up the exchequer. And, you know, this extraordinary statistic of, I don't know, 30 to 50% of the NHS spend being in the last year or two of someone's life. Again, you know, that is the last year or two of people's lives. So, by definition, not a cure. So I think, you've got a really good point there. And the other point, and I totally agree you've just made, is the nature of the research we've been doing. You actually need some fairly cheap and cheerful, pragmatic, place-based research. We must stop trying to answer questions like, does homeopathy work or not? Because forever there'll be trench warfare between those that already believe it doesn't and those already believe it does. And frankly, whatever research you do is never going to change anything. Right. What we really need to know is, if you put that complementary intervention into that patient that's coming to see me with headaches, or you use what we're conventionally using, what is the comparative cost analysis? And that research is simply not being done. It was done a few years ago, you may remember, in Northern Ireland, when we did this research and we took two GP practices, one in Londonderry, one in Belfast, and we the GPs were able to refer to complementary practitioners. And the outcomes are pretty devastating. That's to say, patients were really much more satisfied and helped by it. Their health was improved. The GPs universally felt that this had totally changed the conversation between them and their patients, and also their quality of life. And there was less prescriptions, and overall money was saved because partly because of days saved in work. Now, that was not definitive research by any means. It was extremely suggestive, and any sane person looking at that research would say, "Well, let's go on and do that properly."
Yeah.
Fortunately, again, it was Alan Johnson, Secretary of State. He said, yes, we must do that on the mainland. And we'd set up a group chaired by Sir Cyril Chandler that was going to do precisely that, to try and reproduce that research, pragmatic-based research, to see if referral to complementary practitioners was actually doing better for patients and cheaper. Now, sadly, he went on to the Home Office 10 days before that was about to be announced. And we've been unable to persuade any subsequent Secretary of State to do the same. But it's very unfair, really. And though people use evidence-based as the argument, there is actually an inbuilt prejudice in the system. Some of this is good old entrenched lines between different professional groups and the like. And it's all veiled in terms of evidence. It's veiled in terms of these other things. But that's a bit we've got to overcome. And that, going back to the beginning, is why I do have hope, because I do see these young doctors, nurses and therapists. They don't live in the same world of fighting their own tribe, us and them. Yeah. You know, they're there for the patients. It's great.
That's very good. Yeah, I like that. Okay, last question. So you and I, we're all too aware of the desperate shortcomings in oncology services in the UK. You know, there's huge gaps in care. Traditionally, the GP's role has been to refer a patient to see an oncologist, and that's like bye-bye after that, because if they're diagnosed in any way, that would have been the last time they saw them, probably for months, if at all.
That's right.
Now, I'm harbouring a hope that the GPs might actually pop up with a brand new role here. The emergence of social prescribing, the emergence of personal health budgets, and the GP's burgeoning interest in functional medicine, which is also running alongside in parallel, are three things which, in a way, to me, position GPs to be extremely well placed to fill in the gaps in care that there are in the oncology ward that are not likely to get filled in any time soon, as far as I can see. It's going to need to come from somewhere else, I think. So I wonder whether you think I'm just dreaming there, or whether this is something that could actually happen, where the GP has a much stronger role in supporting cancer patients during treatment.
I would love that to happen. I'm mystified. I mean, patients come back having had the most wonderful treatment for their cancer, but never a discussion, for instance, on their diet.
Right.
Or what they should be doing exercise wise, and it seems to me these are enormous gaps which need filling, which is what you imply. And I would love it if GPs or maybe specialist nurses were to fill that gap. The problem in general practice at the moment, as you know, Robin, is the number of GPs in absolute terms has been decreasing year on year for the last 4 or 5 years. The conversations that go on behind closed doors in most general practices, we have to have these conversations on what less we're going to do. You know, I mean, for instance, in this practice, the thing that breaks my heart is we're having to balance how quickly people can make an appointment with whether they can see their own doctor. So for years we used to have personal lists where you registered with me, and if 5 o'clock in the afternoon you had chest pain or something happened to you, I would be responsible, say, to do a visit on my way home or answer the phone in clinic. Unfortunately now the demands in the system are so much that if I did that I would be working till midnight. So we've had to create two systems in the practice. One is a system where if you really need a doctor that day, I'm here, doc in the box, as it were, answering with a nurse and a paramedic. And then if you want to book to see me as your doctor, you have to make an appointment. But the more I'm having to man the emergency service, the less appointments I have for you to come and see me as personal doctoring, and the longer the wait. So at the moment, access for people on the center is really good, although we're probably getting 200 calls now on a Monday, which have to translate into telephone visits, consultations. But my access as a personal doctor is much worse. You're having to wait 2, 3, 4 weeks sometimes. So what do? You say, well, blow that. I can't wait with my abdominal pain for 2 or 3 weeks. I'll go into the same day service. So what happens is you then get unhitched from your personal doctor. Yeah. And our consultation rates with our own patients were 80 or 90% 5 years ago. Now they're down to 50 or 60%, which actually is still better than national average. Right. But it's not good enough, because all the research that's been done, and I've been contributing a bit myself, has shown that if you have your own doctor you identify with, you are less likely to have a prescription, you're less likely to require admission or hospital referral, your health is likely to be better, and you're likely to be more satisfied. So in fierce cost economic terms, but also if you ask patients who are over 65, seriously ill, or who have a long-term disease, they feel that having a personal doctor is really important, someone for whom the buck ends, and we're losing that. So that's just an illustration of some of the, you know, some of the really difficult decisions we're having to make in general practice at the moment. So coming back to your question, yes, I would love the doctor to be offering an integrated oncology service in primary care. That's where it should be. That's where it should always have been, really. But just at the moment, we're simply not, don't have the resources and the and, you know, and the time and the headroom to do that.
I wonder whether the pressure for that might come from, you know, obviously resources appear when they're, you know, people say they really want them.
Yes.
And it'd be nice to, I'm just thinking this as a concept that one makes complete sense, and as you said, you just said, is where it always should be,
is the
GP. And but it's actually only emerged in my mind relatively recently, as I've seen the changes that are happening in GPs. You know, they're becoming much more health promoters in that way, which is what you need. And, so it's a relatively new idea to me. I've always had my attention focused on the oncology department, which is like, well, you know, it's a desert in terms of health promotion. Yes. And so that's why I've been quite excited by the rise in interest.
I really like the idea. So we have an integrated primary health oncology team.
Yeah.
And that seems to me totally sensible, because that way you can be looking at the feeding, the day-to-day life, the benefits, and you know, and the help and care and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And then you go to the hospital if you're very specialist stuff to do with the chemotherapy. But you don't rely on the hospital to do all the rest of the stuff. And anyway, half it's not being done anyway.
They're useless at and they don't know anything about it.
Yeah. So it's a change of gravity.
You know, you say they don't even talk to them about their diet. Well, when they do, they just say, oh, it doesn't matter at all. You know, just as long as you keep eating. That's really it, you know.
Yes, and, yes.
And that's for real. I mean, I know that from a survey we did recently. They're still saying that stuff, just the same as they always did.
Yes.
Nothing's changed.
And people, you know, when they have cancer and come and see me and say, can you give me some advice on diet and the like, they really like to have a lead in these things. They really like to have some direction. And simply being told not to worry about these things is actually almost demoralising.
Right, exactly. It is a real blow to people who are actually interested to find out what they can do to help themselves. I'm going to leave it there.
Well,
I know the mindset you put out at the beginning, which is where you're more aware of all the things you're not doing yet, which you'd like to be doing. I know that one. But I hope you're also really proud of everything you have done here. I mean, it has set a new standard. And there are places emerging now that look quite a lot like this, I'm glad to say. You know, I'm talking to doctors who have other practices which are, you know, beginning to feel like this as well.
The latter part of comment is so gratifying, because I'm finding lots of places like Frohman's and Austell and up in Ilfracombe who are doing that. The sad thing in this surgery is we lost 3 years, because while I was trying to fight for social prescription nationally, I'd run out of friends to sponsor Ruth, who had been a social prescriber for 10 years. So for 3 years she had to become a receptionist here. So we had to go to sleep while the rest of the country was waking up. But anyway, that's history.
Part of that two-hatted thing I described, micro and the macro.
I felt so bad because, you know, on the one hand things were taking off nationally, on the other hand the home fires were not burning.
All right, well anyway, thanks for welcoming me here today. It's been really great, and also a personal thank you for your support for Yes to Life almost since day one, which has been fantastic.
Well, may I reciprocate, Robin, your determination and your intrepidness and your never give up philosophy has seen, you know, Yes to Life thrive, and I think, you know, we've been talking about the philosophy of giving rather than taking and the philosophy of creating movements, and you know, you embody all of that. Many congratulations for your perseverance.
Thanks. Well, progress towards integration may have been glacially slow in the UK, but for the steps that have been taken, we are all indebted to Dr. Dixon for his work as a key driving force behind these innovations. As I mentioned at the outset, the big week off starts on 12th of January. So if you're interested in a January detox that will also support the vital work of Yes to Life, you can find out more on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, or by listening to last week's Yes to Life show on Listen on Demand here on UK Health Radio. Very best wishes to you all for the coming year. I hope it's filled with good or at least improving health, with friendship and with love, topped off with a respectable portion of fun. Thanks for listening and for your continuing support. Please join me again next week for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.